I want to welcome you to Dream Chasers Radio with me, your host, Yaya Diamond. What's up, peoples? Today is the author edition. Oh, okay. I get so very excited. Can you imagine? This is what I do for a living. Oh, my gosh. This is amazing to me, and I love it. I love meeting people. And we have the book. That's the QR code right there. You guys can get it. It's called The Cubonic Plague. We're going to work on that cube thing. And we have Carolyn on the show today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Appreciate the audience.
Thank you. So, I always go in with, tell me a little bit about yourself and how did this lead up to writing books? Book or books?
Yeah, I've always been a prolific writer. And I think the biggest thing was after about 20 years or so in corporate America, there were so many themes, primarily man's inhumanity to man, and the fact that people were not recognizing what real diversity of thought is. The thought didn't occur to anybody that people could have different thoughts. So you could look different, but you had to think the same way. And I don't do well in those types of environments. I didn't do well. I was kind of an upstart. I was kind of a troublemaker. I wanted to stretch things and see where we could take the organization, how we could do much better. And I felt so much about that, the crust of middle management in organizations holding everybody back.
Yeah.
So it was time to break through. I mean, it's not even the glass ceiling so much. And by the way, the glass ceiling is a one-way mirror. They can see down, but you can't see up. I'm sorry. I got that backwards. You can see up. They can't see down.
You just messed me up all the way through. It doesn't matter which way it is.
Yeah. I mean, they look down and see the image of themselves, and they preen over that. But you can see them and everything that's going on, including their underwear. So it's kind of the glass ceiling was one thing. There were a lot of problems with women in corporate America treated, not the best. And it's funny because when I talk to people in their early 20s getting into corporate America today, they don't really understand that. I really have to explain it to them because today things are a lot different, thank goodness. But the problem is there's still this idea that diversity of thought should be squashed at any cost. And so I started writing and sort of thinking about what I was doing. The first thing I really wrote to the subject was a poem called The Snow Globe. And it's basically the Christmas globe that you flip around and the snow goes there, but the snow always goes to the bottom. Yet the liquid is always free to roam the whole substance of the globe.
Yeah.
And it was just that difference, that stark difference between people who had the freedom to take, they had the run of the place, and the people that were always kept down below had to know their place. And after so much of doing this, it was about 98 when I wrote that poem, and I ended up doing an anthology of poetry that was published in 2015. But I had gotten so many stories, so many things that happened in corporate America that you can't make up. I mean, this stuff is just the way people act, the way they treat other people. So I started writing up a lot of it. It was about 2004 when I really took the stab and I identified this is the cubonic plague. You're in a sea of cubes in corporate America sitting there, and people go into work in the morning and they have a relatively good level of energy. I mean, they have some energy. By the end of the day, they're zapped. They've been beaten down and they have to go home to rejuvenate. But they do this day in and day out. And I mean, that's the definition of insanity. And I found myself feeling insane that I was doing this all the time, but told, you wear the company hat when you come in here. And of course, that was explained to me many times through the years because I wanted to be different. And the real interesting thing was every time I tried to help other people share some idea that I had or share some way of doing something, I was treated like a pariah. I was treated like I must have some hidden agenda or motive. In fact, one CIO, he said, you're in sell mode. And I didn't even understand what he was saying at first, but then I realized they don't understand that I really am honestly trying to help somebody by sharing this type of a document with them. And yeah. And they didn't get it because that was not their world. They didn't share things. They didn't help their fellow man. And, you know, it's funny, a boss I had in the early or through the 80s, Jack Simpson, and he was so phenomenal. And he said one thing to me that was so simple, yet so profound. He said, we're here to help each other. And that's really what it's all about. Do the next right thing and help other people. That's and, right. You know, that's my prayer every day that I can do those things. So the book was an idea of putting together some comical stories, some spoofs on corporate America, the government, and just pointing out the absurdity of everything. Do we really need to have a lot of these things in place that are sort of keeping us constrained, keeping us from getting to the next level of organizational success? Mm. We're holding ourselves back. We're our own worst enemy. And today I do a lot of consulting and a lot of webinars and training and things I enjoy and things where I don't have to go into a corporate environment and deal with all the drama and all the, you know, the things that really just don't do any good for anybody.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. That's why I said, I am so happy you did that, do what I do. I am so happy to be here. Just to do this as a living is just a blessing for me. Because I don't know if I could have gone through what you went through in corporate America. You know, it's, to me, it's like, I'm good. I can't do it. Brave. I mean, that is a brave thing. So how long did it take you to write this book? Because, I mean, did you write it? Were you writing it before you came out of corporate America? I mean, how did that come about?
Well, I was still in corporate America up until COVID. I was still taking jobs and I was doing a lot of contract work because IT is kind of my background.
Right.
So I was doing a lot of contract work and at least you could stay somewhere. And once the politics and everything really got to you, you were ready to go somewhere else. And so that worked okay, but it just gave me more stories to add. And I was really writing it from 2004, I started. And there were years I didn't even touch it. And then I would get a spurt and I would have time. So it was really as time permitted and as my, you know, I had the energy and the, you know, motivation to do it. It took a good 20 years to get it published.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Trying to get my story straight, trying to get the anecdotes and embellishing them and putting hyperbole in a lot of places. Mm-hmm. But trying to say, are we really this dumb? You know, are we really living in a world where this is the norm? I couldn't understand it as the norm. And yeah. To me, government, the difference from government over corporate industry, government was just bigger and it was worse because people couldn't get fired. And so people took advantage of that. You had a completely different sort of an organizational culture in government versus industry. Industry, right. Everybody's trying to fight each other to get to the top. In government, everybody's just like, I'm good. Leave me alone. I'm going to retire.
Yeah.
And I found so many people that at one point had shared my same feelings about that crust of middle management, holding everybody back. But once they became middle management, they turned on a dime. They became the oppressors. Mm. So it was basically the bubonic plague is that malaise that sets in through the day as you don't even realize you have a plague, but you're being beaten down. You are watching other people get beaten down all the time. And because of that, you feel very less worthy of anything. It really destroys people's own ambitions. It destroys people's own sense of confidence and wanting to do better. It really cuts to people's ability to do their best. You're not setting people up for success. You're setting them up for, I wouldn't say necessarily failure, but for mediocrity. Mm. You're telling people just keep doing the same things. Don't rock the boat. You only have so many years to retirement. Just hang in there. And I couldn't go to work every day like that. I didn't define work as me. Work wasn't me. me is who I am. And if I can't think and be myself in an environment, I just don't function very well. Yeah. So that was the course of doing this over time. And it was very cathartic, very much getting rid of a lot of things that were cluttering my mind and had bothered me, and just get them out there and share them with the world. And
yeah, definitely.
Feel my pain, you know.
I do that. What? I mean, yes. Yes. So did you have a particular audience or person in mind when you wrote this book?
It was kind of for everyone, because the themes that run through it, man's inhumanity to man, being kind to other people, you know, doing something out of the ordinary. Those are the kinds of things that all people really have in common. We all want to be loved. That's really what it comes down to. And so how do you get to a place where you can actually earn a living and feel not that the company loves me, but that they respect me and that they value my difference, the diversity I bring. And so there could be plenty of other women who look just like me, but they're not going to always think the same way. And the assumptions and the stereotypes and all of that was really, it was troubling, because a lot of times I didn't even realize what was behind it. And when I realized what was behind it, it was their fear that they were going to get shown up or that someone was going to do better than them. And if you've got a fear like that going into the corporate world, how do you play on a team? You know, I mean, if you saw a basketball team go out there and everybody who's playing, the five people on the court for each team, if they're so focused on not letting somebody else show them up and they're trying to be the hot dog, how's that game going to go? And the thing I found so interesting is that the element of coaching is not introduced in corporate America as something of value, something that needs to be done. All of a sudden, everybody said, well, we need managers because managers can crack the whip and keep the horses running around the track with blinders on. And you don't do anything different because you'll get trampled. But if you want people if you want to lead them to something better, you need to have that vision and be able to raise them up and see other pastures. There are other pastures where those horses could run. They don't have to run around the track and have blinders on, but the leaders are needed to do that. And one big problem with corporate America is they look at leadership and management as being the same thing, and it's not. Managers, the intent is to control and manage what work is going on. The leader has to show that vision and has to coach people. There has to be a coach of some kind coaching people to be their best. You want the people working for you or with you to be their very best. Okay. And so how do you do that? And it's kind of like raising children. You want to raise them to be the best person they can be as an adult. And why don't we apply those types of common sense solutions in the corporate? Why aren't there coaches in the corporate world? That's, you know, we talk about mentoring and all that, but that becomes something where I found that the people doing the mentoring, it was all about them. It wasn't always, you know, going and really helping other people. It was about something they could check off in their bucket list. And there was a point in time, it was probably the early 2000s or mid 2000s. Every person who was a manager or above, they had to have a legacy. What's my legacy? All of a sudden people are trying to create their own legacy. I had one guy who actually thought his legacy was going to be that he was a people person. And what he did to prove that was to call you on your birthday and wish you a happy birthday. And I thought, don't these people have any sense of who they are? Do they not know self-awareness? Do they realize that this is not a game but it's always the checklist? And it shouldn't be a checklist. It's not like I'm going to go to work today and I'm going to do X, Y, and Z. There may be things you're going to do, but I want to be my best. I want to help other people. I want to show other people maybe something I did that was beneficial, or, you know, and a lot of the purpose of the book is I went through a lot of that, the hard lessons learned, they were learned through pain. And so you know, if I can help somebody avoid those lessons, having to learn the hard way.
Yes.
You know, that's a lot of what the book is about. So it's really, the audience is anyone who is willing to think differently, willing to consider something. They may not agree with my politics or the way I look at organizations, but think about it. I'm not telling you I'm right, you're wrong. I'm telling you there are other ways to think about things. And that's really the message.
Nice. Wow. You know, okay. So like, are there any parts in this book or any characters in this book that are based on you, your real life?
The grandmother, Grandma Kay, she is very much, I guess I modeled her on myself. And I didn't even realize it until I was developing the character and she was coming out. And she has a lot of the attributes I have. She was one who was an upstart. She was one who, she was very responsible, very accountable, did her job well, but she knew there was more to life. Mm-hmm. And she had the family, the importance of family as primary over what she was doing at work. And she did what she could, given the fact that in the book, she's in corporate America in the 60s, 70s, 80s, where it was even worse for women. But she still managed to write in her journal every day. And it was the thought she put in the journal that was found by someone in the book who actually took her idea and made it come to life. Ooh. So it was like she set that foundation for that to be happening. And someone was just fortunate enough to come by and find that information and take it and make it into something profitable, actually profitable. So she was sort of my hero in the book, and she was very practical, common sense, she looked at people as individuals. Not treating everybody the same way, but treating people according to how they want to be treated, right, and how you can respect them, and you can disagree. Certainly there's always a time for that, but do it respectfully. And that was really a lot of the, building that character out over time, but she had guts. She had tenacity. She had strength and courage. And I always thought I did as well, or at least I always felt like I did. And in fact, when I was struggling in one company, the CIO said, I had brought to their attention something they were doing that was actually illegal. It was a very large company. And he said to me, some people would think you were courageous. Other people would think you were stupid. And I knew immediately what he thought. He wasn't giving me the time of day for anything. I was just a pain in his neck. So, it's interesting when you have those conversations with people that most people don't have those types of conversations, but I pushed it and kind of made it my business to ask the questions. And the answers were very revealing about what the people were thinking, the hidden agendas. That was pretty startling.
Wow. Yeah. You know, I kind of gather that you really like this grandma. Is she your favorite character in this book?
I think she is. Mm-hmm. I kind of like Grandpa Kay, her husband, because he's a little bit in and out of it with sort of some dementia periodically. So he's funny. But he's also somebody who believes in himself, that he is going to develop the greatest fuel in the world. And it's his mission. And he never gives up on it, no matter what happens. No matter how many workshops he blows up, he still is intent on getting success. So these are people that really have that ethic, that feeling that if they try hard enough, they might be able to do something. Maybe not what they thought they would do, but they're going to do something, right, and make a difference. And everybody should just, I feel, be at a point where I may not change the world, but I'll do what I can to change first myself, to be better in the world, and then to influence other people, however I can.
Definitely. Okay, so you lump, girl, you messed up. You just like the government in this book. But is there like a comparison from the government? What do you think between the government and the industry? Is there a difference?
I think the difference is the fact that government jobs are much more protected. than an industry. So what I found in and it was interesting, I worked for one government agency as a director of IT for some very short period of time. And one of the guys that reported to me came in the first day and he said, "You're not a government employee. You can't tell me what to do." Ooh. I mean, flat out. Ah. So it's that entitlement. I have the job in the government. Nobody can do anything to me. And if they do, I'm going to cry foul. In corporate America, it's more quiet. Stay under the radar. Don't make yourself noticed. Your purpose is not to show yourself off or what you do. Your purpose is to not make anyone else look bad. It should be to make other people look good. You know, anybody who tries to make somebody else look good and gives them the credit for what they did, that's rare in corporate America. You don't see that too much. So it's always interesting to see people who actually do care about other people and credit them for things that they came up with. And it's not that I'm, you know, I didn't need the pat on the back or somebody to tell me I was doing a good job. I answered to my own value of, you know, what I thought I should be doing. I always knew if I was doing well or not. I didn't need somebody to tell me that. But the fact that there were so many times when someone ignored what I said and then a week later said the same thing as if they never heard it before.
I told this, like I said that already. I mean, I literally told you that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I'd be sitting there like kind of chuckling to myself, like, does everybody else in the room realize that I presented this a week ago and exactly. This is the same conversation
exactly.
And everyone's looking around like this guy is great. And when I finished my presentation, it was like you could hear a pin drop. I mean, there was no reaction to it. It was like, okay, what's next?
That's so, because they were already thinking of it and they knew that you were smarter than they are. What? Sorry. I just had to say it.
You know, it's not even about being smarter. It's the fact that somebody else may have given me that leg up. So I'm going to share it with you.
Yeah.
You know, but it's always looked at that you have some ulterior motive that is not what we do. It's not how we do things here.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And that's why, you know, that's why I love this platform, because I'm always lifting people up. I love it. I love doing it. I love bringing the attention, like your book, The Bubonic Plague. I love doing that. This is something that is just beautiful to me, to lift people up and to have them go and show what they've done. And it's just a support system, I feel like. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's wonderful. Right. Wonderful. And I love what you've done with your book. You've taken your whole life and you've put it into this book, because to me, it's like, yeah, I know where you're coming from. I've been there. I've done that. I you know, and I will never go back. Is there a sequel to this that you're writing?
I hope so. I did. I wrote probably about 200 pages more than what's in the book.
No.
So I have lots of material. It's just a matter of getting the time and the focus on it. Mm-hmm. But hopefully, yeah, because there is there's life after corporate America.
Oh, yes.
And life is good. You know, I mean, don't make it harder than it has to be.
Oh, no.
But really, I don't miss those days of going in there and looking, and, you know, you didn't know who was looking at you or watching you, and you'd walk through a hallway and someone would give you a look and you weren't sure what that meant. But you know, it didn't feel right. Right. I don't want to be judged by other people so much. I mean, I know that's part of the job when people are supervising other people, but judge what I'm doing. Don't judge me. And that's where the big discrepancy always was.
Hmm. Wow. So who is your favorite author?
I like some different authors and different extremes, sort of. I like Dave Barry. His comedy and his humor is just hysterical to me. But I also like a lot of history books. Ken Follett wrote some, a lot of them about the wars in the world. And also Edward Rutherford. He writes a lot of books about longer back history, thousands of years ago. Following families through generations. What I always find interesting is to hear how other people lived at another time, and given the situation and what they had available and resources and different things, But you always found the two common things. Everybody wanted to be loved, and everybody really wanted to be a good person, or at least perceived as one. It's sort of that sense of humanity. But again, people still in the past, I mean, we see wars today, and there were wars before this. Why do they continue? You know, why is it we can't just stop all that? It baffles my mind. But just the, I think a lot of the hate, a lot of the evil in the world is driven by fear. Fear that someone else is going to conquer me, or I'm not going to be on top. And that fear has got to be, you know, eliminated, where you can disarm people and get them to genuinely really want to do things for the right reason. So it's most of the authors that I read, and I love Agatha Christie. I love mysteries. I love murder mysteries. Those are fun. But those are really the books that I generally go into. And I like different books, things that really give me an idea about another time in life when people had a certain challenge and how they got through it. That's always interesting to me.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Me too. Me too. So what can people expect when they get your book?
They're going to see that I'm really pulling the covers off of corporate America and the government, and I'm exposing it. And whether or not I'm right or wrong, and some of the things I say may not be what other people think, and that's fine. But it's the kind of thing where you can look at it and sort of come to an idea of, well, this is somebody else's way of thinking. If nothing else, it gives people a different perspective if it's not their own already. So that's what I really want people to understand. Think the way you want to think. But, you know, and it goes to teaching today. Critical thinking is one of the most important aspects of what should be in education.
Yes.
And people are not teaching it. Not teaching critical thinking, not asking questions, questioning assumptions, doing things from a different perspective, thinking about what other people know or say, and, well, how much credence do I put in that? But critically thinking, and people really don't have those skills today. I think that's really lacking, and it's absolutely necessary for leadership.
Yeah.
So, I really would like to see more of that in the world.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Carolyn, for being on the show. I appreciate it. It's been such a pleasure.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. I hope people will enjoy the book, because there are some funny things in it, I think, anyway. But just get a different perspective on, you know, maybe not what you always think, but it helps you to think differently. And that's the important part of it.
Yeah, I always say, you know, you got to get the other side of the story. I mean, you got to get going to be one-sided all your life. You're never going to get the complete truth.
Right.
So getting that entire story, you know, is better than having just the half of a story. I mean, you don't have as much excitement when you have just half of a story.
Right.
Thank you. So the QR code is up here in the corner, guys. Go ahead and scan that if that's something that you like to do. It's going to take you to Amazon where you can purchase that book or check it out for yourself. Also, in the description box, we're going to have that information as well. I want to thank you guys so much for tuning in, man. It is the Cubonic Plague, sitting in the cube all this time, and you now are plagued, and you know what we're talking about. If you're sitting in your cube today, I'm not going to say anything. Get out. I'm just going to say that, you know, read the book. Thank you guys so much for tuning in. And again, Carolyn, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate and enjoyed it. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in as well.
Definitely, definitely.
Okay.
Until next time, guys, don't forget to dare to be different. Bye.
Don't forget to follow us on YouTube or Instagram. Thank you for watching.